This is the fourth in this series, the last in this series of reflections on the Christian responsibility to Muslims. And tonight I want to do a little thinking about the Prophet Muhammad. And I'm hoping that I do this in a way that will prompt you to do a little thinking about him as well, and about, particularly about the way in which Christians might come to think about him and talk about him. And I know that my Muslim friends have a lot to say about this, because they care about it. I hope that if any of you deign to be Christian, you might have something to say about it too. But first, I'd like to point out a couple of things that the Ronning Center is doing. One is on the 21st of March. It's going to be here at Trinity, which is a half-day retreat from 9 to 1 on Jesus and nonviolence. It's a retreat that's led by Simon Harrick, who's a Jesuit priest, and he's been involved in issues of religion, violence, and peace for many, many years. He's a wonderful speaker. He also, for whatever reasons, was nominated for the Nobel Prize 3 times. Obviously didn't get it. He teaches at Notre Dame and is the author of numerous books. There's a little leaflet over here on it. And the second one is with Sister Fuchs, who's involved in ecumenism for the Catholic Church in the United States. And she's going to be here doing a number of things, one of which is an ecumenical women's retreat titled Believing and Belonging, which will be here at Trinity on Thursday, March 29th, really from 10 to 3 during the day. And there's a little note on that over there as well. So you're welcome to spread the word on that if you would be inclined. So tonight, thinking about the Prophet Muhammad, Muslims treasure the memory of the Prophet Muhammad as they do that of all the prophets, including Jesus Christ. As one who received the revelation, he was favored by God, and his life experience prepared him for this vocation. His life, at least for some Muslims, is a model, and his teaching, largely through the accounts in the hadith literature, the sayings of the Prophet, come only second to the Quran, the divine revelation itself. So for the faithful, he's both the seal of the prophets and a singular human being, a person of excellence. Now, in my conversation with Muslims over the last several years, I realize that many of them have been deeply troubled by the image of Muhammad that has been fixed in both the European and in the imagination of some of those who would call themselves Christians. That's been so from the 7th century down to our own day. They're equally troubled by the image of Jesus Christ. That hadn't fully dawned on me until I was in Syria, but equally troubled by the image of Jesus Christ that circulates in popular culture, which they also have found quite blasphemous. We don't hear as much of that on our media. The way modern artists have treated Jesus Christ and the crucifixion and the attention that this has garnered in America and in the international media has been baffling to a number of them. To Christians, they ask, and have done so since the time of John of Damascus, why harbor such awful images of the treasured seal of the Prophet Muhammad, whom we love and revere? Why do you not at least see what he means to us and have an appropriate respect for him because of us, and for us because of him? As faithful Muslims, we have an elevated image and understanding of Jesus Christ and his place in the unfolding of revelation, since he is our prophet as well as yours. So I have come to see a kind of hole in the heart of some faithful Muslims, a hole because they simply cannot understand why these awful images about the most excellent of human beings continues to be normal for some who call themselves Christians. It is a dangerous emptiness, so easily used by those who would market fear and galvanize the imagination of some who claim to be Muslims in the face of the West. So in our reflection together, I want to offer a new way for Christians to think about Muhammad, a way that I will argue, I guess, is deeply Christian, a way unlike what has been common, a way free of the tragic historical legacy of such images. At least that's what I hope to do. So first, just to refresh the memory for some of you, who was Muhammad? I'll be brief about this. For Muslims, of course, Muhammad was God's messenger and prophet. He received and proclaimed the same message that had been given to Jews and to Christians and others by the prophets they had received and often rejected down through the ages. His proclamation was first to the Arabs and then to others, first to Ali's family and then to everybody else after that, all of those who had ears to hear. We get a glimpse of Muhammad's historical life in the Quran, but it's very, very brief. And we have to go to the traditional biographies and to the hadith, to the reports on Muhammad's life and teaching, as well as to modern histories to fill out his life. We know that he was born to a large tribe of Hasham in Saudi Arabia, was orphaned at a very young age, and raised largely by his uncle, Abu Talib. When he was about 25, he began to work for a wealthy widow in Mecca, running her large caravans of trade goods to Syria. He would have been at the great Umayyad Mosque in Syria, even though it didn't exist then, it was the church, but he would be preparing the way. Tradition tells us that Khadija proposed marriage to him after witnessing his fine qualities. Four daughters were born to them, and those daughters lived into adulthood, and several at least became significant in the history of Islam. And three sons were born to them, but tragically each one of them died in infancy. And one can only imagine how deeply that must have marked both Khadija and Muhammad. In 610, when Muhammad was about 40, he received the first revelation when the angel Jibril appeared to him and recited what we have come to know as the first five verses of Surah 96. Leading up to that moment, I see a man struggling to make sense out of both his own experience and struggling and to make sense out of the struggles within his society. I'll speak about more of this a little bit later and tell a little story about it. For about 2 years after this initial encounter with the revelation, there was no further revelations. He received assurance that what he had received is indeed from God, and then following this 2-year dry period, the revelations continued without interruptions until he departed this world in 632. We read almost nothing about Muhammad's public ministry in the Quran. It's very different than the Gospels, of course, in many ways, but markedly in that way. For that, we need to go to the biographical sources that have played an important role in the minds and hearts of the faithful. They fill out a kind of portrait of Muhammad. The Quran depicts the prophet as fully human, fully and completely and only human. struggling to be steadfast and patient in the face of persecution. He has no miraculous powers and agonizes over those who did not believe. And the Quran also suggests a man who is deeply humble and shy and sincere. He constantly sought forgiveness for his own sins. This issue of sincerity becomes very vivid, at least it was vivid for me, when I traveled a little bit in Syria and Turkey, to realize how central sincerity is for at least Muslim discourse and thinking about things. His military acumen becomes apparent during the Medina period with victories over the Meccans, and by 627, he was in complete control of Medina and many of the surrounding Bedouin tribes forged alliances with him, and in those alliances became Muslim. In the spring of 628, a treaty with the Meccans grants him permission to make a pilgrimage or a Hajj the following year. The treaty also established a 10-year peace between his community and other tribes in the great trading city. Now, this truce was broken the following year and led to the peaceful surrender of the city to Muhammad. By 630, Muhammad was in command of all of West Central Arabia, and in the years that followed, he sent emissaries throughout the region to negotiate treaties, some of which were followed by massive conversions to Islam. In 632, he led pilgrims on the farewell pilgrimage, the largest gathering of Muslims in his lifetime. And on his return trip to Medina, he contracted a fatal illness and died in June of that year, likely about 60 years old. My old friend, Tom Faulkner, who was a fellow of the Ryan Center and a wonderful professor of religious studies, commented over dinner with Ibrahim Abarabi several years ago that in his view, Muhammad was the greatest man who had ever lived. I remember being startled by this, hearing it from Tom. Tom's a Christian. But of course, I realized immediately that he, in his own mind, would not have included Jesus Christ in that because of his sense that Jesus Christ, while being fully human, was also divine. So why did Tom say this? Well, he went on to speak a little bit about how Muhammad was a civilizing hero who had put together a new and lasting social, political, and religious order. An administrator, a legislator, a judge, a commander-in-chief, as well as a teacher, preacher, and prayer leader. And we have not even gotten around to his key vocation, that of God's messenger and seal of the prophets for the faithful. For Islamic scholars, he is the legislator and jurist par excellence. For mystics, he is the model for those who seek spiritual perfection. For the philosopher and statesman, he is the supreme example of a conqueror and one who does not humiliate the defeated, but rules in a just way. And for the pious Muslim, he is the model of God's grace and salvation, of the person obedient to the beautiful pattern of conduct. Because of this hole that I thought I saw in the heart of Muslims around the image Christians have of Muhammad, I began to think about what Muslims would like to hear Christians say about the Prophet. So recently I posed this question. In fact, it came up really when I was talking with my two friends here for the first time. I posed the question this way. What might Christians say about the Prophet Muhammad that would warm your heart as a Muslim? This question was more difficult, it became apparent, than I had imagined. My interest in writing about Muhammad a little bit for Christians developed earlier in conversations that I had in Turkey and Syria. And colleagues there, particularly in Turkey, they felt the wound that I had talked about at the beginning of my talk here. And they asked that I do write about this and try and find another way for Christians to speak, and that I do it quickly. They wanted to have such an essay in hand so that they could push back against the propaganda within their own communities, which always assumed that all Christians spoke in this blasphemous way about the Prophet and about Islam. We discussed how convenient it had been to have a large cache of such awful images of the Prophet ready at hand to bolster a sense of victimization and to marshal the young to militant ranks against the West and the modern world. In my view, such images share responsibility. Not completely responsible for it, but they share responsibility for the rise of militant Islam. And for this reason alone, it seems to me there needs to be counter-narratives. So what might Christians say about the Prophet Muhammad that would warm your heart? Other colleagues and friends have pointed out that the whole of the human family is related, not through its particular prophets, but through its common creator, who is the master of the Day of Judgment. On several occasions, more was said about Jesus Christ, when I asked this question, than about Muhammad. And I took this as part of the continuity of Muslim reflection on Christianity, trying to assure Christians that Islam is not only friendly to Jesus Christ, but gives him a special and unique place, witnessed to by the amount said about him in the Quran. Jesus' status in the Quran is equal to that of the Prophet Adam, and more. He is the Word of God. And Muhammad affirmed that to the pagans over and over and over again. And we see his special spirit in the birth narrative, that is, in the Quran as well. One of these colleagues also pointed out to me that while Jesus Christ had received God's message, as all prophets do, Christianity was not really made by Jesus Christ, but it was made by the Romans. Now, another colleague said that he often heard Muslims give Muhammad and his companions what had amounted to almost a divine kind of status, and that they needed to restore him to his simple mortal status, and not to elevate him that way. So Muhammad himself was clear on this and spoke many times about how he was simply human and not to be idolized. Another colleague spoke about the importance of restoring Muhammad to the line of descendants from Ishmael. Think about this, those of you who are within the Christian tradition. Perhaps it would be helpful, he said, for Christians to realize what it really means to understand that Ishmael and Isaac were brothers, and both of them had Abraham as their father. Abraham and Ishmael are the ancestors of the Arab tribes, and they established the worship of the one God with the construction of the Kaaba in Mecca. So many of my friends talked about how it would warm their heart if Christians would simply understand that Muhammad was the bearer of the divine message, the Quran. Muhammad is like all the other prophets, and since Christians hold the other prophets dear, they should hold Muhammad dear. This was the most common response to my simple question. My Muslim friends, like many Christians, want others to share in the depth of their faith and become one with them in belief and practice. It is an ultimate concern and rightly stands at the center of their response to my question. I expressed my appreciation for the desire that they had to see Christians become Muslim, or, to put it perhaps more to my friend's liking, becoming more fully faithful to the divine revelation. I pointed out, however, that we were not there, and that my intention is to help Christians who remain Christian to find ways to speak about Muhammad that might warm the heart of faithful Muslims. Is it possible for Christians to consider all prophets as prophets of God? One of my colleagues asked. This response, shaped as a question, well, understandable at first blush, invites numerous problems for both Christians and Muslims. In both our traditions, we have the requirement to discern true prophets from false prophets. In both Islam and Christianity, schism has occurred in the face of such discernment. And you can think of examples. This process of discernment is certainly necessary when a new or further revelation and a new prophet or messenger or somebody who claims to be so arrives on the scene. If members of one's family and community are attracted to this message and if others are threatened by it, there will obviously be serious and often long-term consequences. But what should our stance as Christians be? After 14 centuries, when communities, cultures, and civilizations in so many parts of the world have thrived based on the revelation and on the Prophet Muhammad as teacher and model. Notions of false prophet, which have kicked around in Christian rhetoric so much, are at best inconsequential if they're used as some kind of battle cry. It's over. And more likely, they're on a spectrum between mischievous and harmful in some kind of local way. So what ought the stance of Christians to be? At the invitation of the imam, who sits right here, at the University Hospital Interfaith Chapel, I joined the gathering of faithful for their Friday noon prayer several weeks ago, or a month ago or so now, I guess. Following the prayer, a number of them stayed to talk about my question. They were all medical doctors and came from various countries with large Muslim populations. One of them said that he had never heard any Christian speak disrespectfully about the Prophet Muhammad. That got us off to a lovely start. He could only ask that others respect the Prophet and speak with courtesy about him. Another person suggested that perhaps Christians could speak about Muhammad as a great leader, if not as a prophet. Surely his singular greatness was clear from the modern historical record and should not be too difficult for all people to see. Then an interesting distinction was offered. Various titles are associated with the prophet, along with his being the seal of the prophets. Muhammad is also commonly referred to as a messenger of God and as a servant of God. While Christians may not wish to see him as a messenger of God, might it be possible, our colleague said, might it be possible for them to come to understand that he was God's servant? That he had led the Arab peoples first, and then so many pagan peoples to worship the one God? Would there be any impediment in the teaching of Christianity to referring to Muhammad as a servant of God? As I listened to my interlocutor unfold this possibility, my thoughts turned to the occasions when I have addressed somebody as the servant of God, or when I have been addressed as a servant of God. It is a common form of address among Orthodox Christians. At Holy Communion, for example, the priest will normally say, "The servant of God, David, receives the body and blood of our Lord. In writing to a person who is struggling, either with some aspect of faith or with the organized inadequacies of life, I have often addressed them as the servant or the handmaiden of God. If you receive a letter from an Orthodox monastery, you will be addressed in this way. It's the common way for monasteries to write to people. It makes no difference, at least to most of them, whether you are an Orthodox Christian or not. There is no litmus test for this. And I'll return to this suggestion in a little while. So now that I have sketched out a little bit how I came to explore rethinking the Prophet Muhammad, and before I endeavor to draw some conclusions, I want to recount several stories to you about him. They put a face on him. And since for Christians, all human beings are created in the image of God, no matter who they are, I would like to flesh out this remarkable human being just a touch prior to trying to draw some conclusions about how we ought to be thought about by Christians. So I have three little stories to talk about with you, and some of you will know these and others may not. The first one I call the curious preparation. The Muslim tradition of biography and story about Muhammad elaborates on the various portents associated with his birth and with his mother Amina's sense that she was carrying someone very special in her womb. Muhammad was born into a noble Meccan family, Banu Hashim, a family that many of the clans of the city held in high regard. When Amina was in her second month of pregnancy, her husband and Muhammad's father, Abdullah, died while on a trip north of Mecca. So at his birth, he was to live with the tension of the dual status implied in Mecca by a respectable descent on the one hand and the precariousness of having no father on the other. His grandfather took responsibility for him as an infant, and like Amina, he too sensed the very special nature of this newborn child. Now, it was customary in Mecca, among important families, to find a wet nurse among the nomadic Bedouin tribes and give the child to that wet nurse to raise for a period of time. There's this sense in that part of the world that the Bedouin experience is deeply formative and also deeply spiritual. But this was difficult. It was difficult to find somebody because the likely candidates to be the wet nurse for him were superstitious and didn't want to be associated with an infant whose father had died before the child had been born. But finally, a woman of the Banu Sa'd Bedouins in the Arabian desert named Halima took the infant into her care, suckled him, and nurtured him. He was with the family for the first 4 years of his life, formed in the barren and difficult environment of the desert, a place where the endless horizons heighten one's sense of the fragility of being human, a place that inclines everyone to contemplation and makes solitude a normal part of life. Tariq Ramadan has pointed out that Muhammad's life as an orphan and his formative experience in the desert was echoed in the Quran. Did he not find you an orphan and give you shelter? And he found you wandering and he gave you guidance. And he found you in need and made you independent. Therefore, do not treat the orphan with harshness, nor chide him who asks, but the bounty of your Lord proclaim. Muhammad's mother died when he was 6, leaving him utterly dependent on God, but also close to the most destitute among peoples. So it's not surprising that in the Quran, again and again, we are reminded, just as in the Hebrew, with the Hebrew prophets and with the words of Jesus Christ, to care for and not forsake widows and orphans, the poor of the world, those who are in deep need. Muhammad never forgot his early years. And we will see this echoed a bit in the third story I will tell you tonight. So what can we draw from this experience? In the desert, Muhammad learned from the rich Bedouin oral tradition, its eloquence, the charming turn of phrase that captures so much in a few words, and the very haunting chant that characterizes Bedouin culture and that we see reflected in much of Muslim chant down to our own day. It is a chant that on the one hand speaks of the yearning for God, and on the other hand, it gives you a profound apprehension of finitude. So many prophets, of course, came from the deserts of the Levant, and there are lessons in this. Nomads are always moving. They're always on the move. They're specks within a massive sea of sand, following the moon and the stars, seeking an oasis in the middle of the day or at the end of the day. Freedom is blended with fleetingness, with vulnerability, with humility. Nomads are comfortable being strangers. Muhammad, drawing on this childhood experience, described the spiritual life in these terms to a young Abdullah ibn Umar: be in this world as if you were a stranger or a wayfarer. And it is the desert that also spoke to him of the presence of the Creator and the wonder of creation. The desert, which often appears so devoid of life, will yield to the watchful observer the miracle of the return of life. So through his early experiences, Muhammad came to see nature as the primary guide for the faithful and the most intimate companion in the unfolding of the spiritual life. Prophets learn from the desert. It becomes a spiritual teacher and moves the heart and mind from encounters with finitude to the majesty of God, from the contemplation of what appears to be lifeless to consciousness of that which is life-giving being called forth from the most barren of places. Muhammad learned this in the first 4 years of his life. Let me give you a second story. I call it spiritual struggle and openness to the divine. When Muhammad was nearly 40, he had reached a point in his spiritual life familiar to many Christians, many human beings, I think, and common certainly to the lives of saints in the Christian tradition. His search for meaning had intensified, and he would retreat to one of the caves near Mecca, a practice he no doubt had seen both Christians doing as well as the Meccan Hanafi community, the community in Mecca that were monotheists. We also have several biblical accounts of such times of withdrawal, such times of struggle, such times of searching out one's vocation, seeking resolution in the face of the temptation to despair or the temptation for cynicism. Moses sojourned behind the mountain and encountered, and the encounter with the bush that burned and was not consumed comes to my mind when I first read the account of Muhammad going to the cave. And Jesus Christ, 40 years in the desert, and his encounter with the tempter also comes to mind. Now, I'm not talking about equivalencies here, but only pointing to what is the remarkable common feature of the spiritual life for those who seek to be servants of God. For Muhammad, it was the month of Ramadan, and he went to the cave of Hira with a little supply of food. The cave was high up and accessible only by a narrow path, secluded, but with a view of the Kaaba far below. The barren plain stretched out in every direction, and like an early Christian monk, he had sought the desert place to work out his salvation. It was here in the cave that he was greeted. Peace be upon you, messenger of God. The angel Gabriel appeared to him and ordered him to read. And Muhammad answered, "I am not one of those who read." The angel, the accounts tell us, held him tightly and insisted. Again and a third time, Muhammad answered, "I am not of those who read." The angel said, "Read in the name of your Lord." And the word in Arabic for it, Rab, educator, in the name of your educator, who created humankind out of a clinging clot. Read, and your Lord is most bountiful. He who taught by means of the pen taught humankind that which they did not know. Muslims know these words as the first verses of the Quran. Muhammad was deeply troubled by this encounter. And in some accounts, we read of him taking flight from the cave and running frantically down the mountain and home and throwing himself into his wife's arms and asking her to cover him with a cloak. He told her what had happened. He told her about how stricken he was with uncontrollable fear. Was he going mad? Was he being courted by an evil spirit? Khadija comforted him and assured him of his goodness and of God's protection and grace. She then went and sought the advice of a cousin who was a Christian. And this cousin who was a Christian identified the angel who had come to Muhammad as the same one who had come to Moses. Indeed, Muhammad is the prophet of his people. So this particular Christian cousin is a kind of John the Baptist figure in Islam, if you want to draw a comparison. And sometime later on, this cousin, on meeting Muhammad, spoke a bit more to him and said that he will certainly, as a result of receiving the revelation, be called a liar, be ill-treated, be banished and attacked. But he said, "If I am still alive then, God knows, I will support you and bring his cause to victory." Now, to faithful Muslims, this account marks the beginning of Muhammad's mission. It is the moment of receiving his vocation. It speaks to his desire for an intimate relationship to God as much as it does to his fear and trembling in the presence of the divine message. He is deeply dependent on his wife, Khadija, for assistance that what he had heard is not the product of his own mind or the deceptive words of one of the principalities and powers that roam the cosmos. Others had to coax him, persuade him, to return to attentiveness to the messenger sent to him so that he can be a bearer of the message to others. He is, in a way, in the heat of a hard-won spiritual struggle. And this the accounts of this that I have read are remarkably, they echo the kind of spiritual struggle you read in many of the desert fathers and other people within Christian tradition who seek friendship with God and become overpowered in the midst of it. Let me give you my third story. Excellence trumps justice. It's my final story, and it speaks of Muhammad's deep concern to move beyond justice to the kind of excellence that, in the language of the New Testament, makes all things new. The prophet held one of his companions, called Abu Labada, in great esteem, so much so that he had left him in charge of Medina when he had left for the first Badr expedition. And then he returned, and sometime later, a young orphan came to Muhammad to complain that Abu Labada had taken from him a palm tree that had long been his. The prophet summoned Abu Labada and asked him to explain. Investigation showed that the palm tree did belong to Abu Labada, and the prophet judged in his companion's favor, greatly disappointing the young orphan, who thereby lost his most precious belonging. Now, in the hadith, it says that Muhammad privately asked Abu Labada, "Justice having now been rendered to you, why don't you give the tree to the orphan? It's so important for him." But Abu Labada adamantly refused to do so. He had gone to such lengths to assert his right of ownership that to concede to the request was inconceivable for him. Besides which, the orphan had gone and told the prophet about this. You know, it was embarrassing. This obsession veiled his heart and veiled his compassion. Revelation was to recall on both the individual and collective levels the singular nature of the spiritual elevation that makes it possible to reach beyond the consciousness of justice that demands rights, to the excellence of the heart that offers forgiveness or gives people more than their due. From the Quran, God commands justice and excellence. It was not a question of giving up one's right. Abu Labada had been justified in requiring that it be acknowledged. But rather it involved learning to sometimes reach beyond for the sake of those reasons of the heart that teach the mind to forgive, to let go, and to give from oneself and from one's belongings, moved by shared humanity and love. In the hadith, it says that the prophet was saddened by the reaction of his companion, whom he held in great esteem. He realized that Abu Labada's almost blind attachment to one of Islam's recommendations, justice, prevented him from reaching the superior level of justness of the heart, excellence, generosity, the place of grace. Now, eventually, another companion who had witnessed this scene came to Abu Labada and offered to trade him an orchard of palm trees for that one palm tree. And Abu Labada did. And then that companion gave the palm tree back to the orphan. When the prophet heard of this, he rejoiced at the outcome. But it also says in the hadith that he never held it against Abu Labada. Those are three stories to just give you a little sense of the Prophet Muhammad. So now to my conclusion and suggestion that I want to talk with you about. So I've explored the question, what can Christians say about Muhammad that would warm the heart of Muslims? I had hoped it would be fruitful, and probably I'd hoped it would be more fruitful than I think it is. But you can be the judge of that, and we can talk about that. But let me conclude with a few avenues for us to think about and perspectives that we might seek to layer into our conversation on this theme. One of the most elementary considerations for Christians is to remember the Decalogue and the commandment, "Thou shalt not bear false witness." In recent years, I have reminded a concerned Lutheran clergyman of this commandment after receiving his email missives filled with references to Muslim hate literature. I just asked him to be faithful to the commandment. Now, I think it is reasonable to critique the actions of militant Muslims and to challenge at least some of the perspectives of political Islam in light of modern culture and liberal democratic values that are part of the treasure of the West. It's not about not critiquing, but it's quite another matter to massify Islam and see it through the prism of militant movements. That is a form of bearing false witness. And it is quite another to reduce the meaning of the Prophet to a set of propagandistic images hatched out of fear and in the heat of the expansion of new empires and the pushback called the Crusades. From a strategic point of view, I argued in my first lecture that this only plays into the hands of the very people those that do it wish to critique. Osama bin Laden, when he was living, also saw Islam and faithfulness as manifest only in a particular form of jihad. He reduced Islam to that. So to take up this awful rhetoric, this Lutheran pastor had become a bedfellow with his enemy. But this is not the most troubling aspect of failing to keep this commandment. When Christians fall prey to this temptation, they endanger their own spiritual health. They diminish their sanctity, and they ruin their relationship with their brothers and sisters who treasure the pathways and disciplines revealed in the Quran. But I did not ask this question simply to suggest what ought not to be said by Christians, but rather I'm interested in what capacity we have as Christians to speak words of regard for Muhammad, words that may begin to heal the wound in the heart of many Muslims, given the centuries of awful rhetoric born of fear and loathing. The Roman Catholic Church responded in part to this issue when Pope Paul VI promulgated Nostra Aetate, the Declaration on the Relationship of the Church to Non-Christians, on October 28, 1965. This document, which reoriented the Roman Catholic Church, resulted from the work of the Second Vatican Council. The document points to the common origin of the human race, the impulse to respond to that hidden power which hovers over the course of all things, and a sense that cultures throughout time have spoken in various ways to help people engage the great questions of human meaning that are offered by common human experience. Here's what Nostra Aetate says about Islam. The Church regards with esteem also the Muslims. They adore the one God, living and sustaining in himself, merciful and all-powerful, the creator of heaven and earth, who has spoken to human beings. They take pains to submit wholeheartedly to even his inscrutable decrees, just as Abraham, with whom the faith of Islam takes pleasure in linking itself, submitted to God. Though they do not acknowledge Jesus as God, they revere him as a prophet. They also honor Mary, the Virgin Mother. At times, they even call on her with devotion. In addition, they await the day of judgment when God will render their deserts to all those who have been raised up from the dead. Finally, they value the moral life and worship God, especially through prayer, almsgiving, and fasting. Since in the course of centuries, not a few quarrels and hostilities have arisen between Christians and Muslims, this sacred synod urges all to forget the past and to work sincerely for mutual understanding and to preserve as well as to promote together for the benefit of all mankind social justice and moral welfare as well as peace and freedom. Now, given the history of the West and the Roman Catholic Church, this document is laudable. No longer can Catholics look upon Islam and Muslims through the lens of the past, through the lens of fear, the lens of that awful discourse. It is striking, however, that the fathers of the council did not find it within themselves to mention the name of Muhammad. And perhaps this was more freight than the council could bear. But it's almost 50 years since 1965, so I think we can consider what Christians ought to think about Muhammad. Muhammad was a civilizing hero to my colleague Tom Faulkner. Modern letters has brought this forward, and we now have popular books written which make this point in clear and laudatory terms. Karen Armstrong's Muhammad, A Prophet for Our Time, published in HarperCollins' Eminent Lives series, is an example, and there are many others. All men and women who move culture into a new way of ordering existence, into new arrangements that over time prove useful, and at least in some sense, uniting, do so in the midst of the cut and thrust of history. It is always messy. It is never neat and clean. Certainly, Muhammad can be granted as much leeway as we commonly grant to others in the West and elsewhere that have revolutionized the way of life of so many in the human family. What Muhammad did as conqueror, legislator, and statesman, while historically significant, is only a small aspect of who we know him to be. As my friend, the historian Nicholas Wickenden, recently said, and I think he said it here, I can love Muhammad for his remarkable achievements, including the bringing about of new civil forms, but I do not have to believe everything he said. For the faithful of Islam, Muhammad, of course, is the seal of the prophets, the last prophet, if not the last messenger. And, of course, many would assume the only proper response to him would be to accept him as the seal of the prophetic tradition and become Muslim. My interest lays in the capacity of Christian tradition to hold Muhammad with regard, and so I come to my final argument. 2 summers ago, I read Tariq Ramadan's In the Footsteps of the Prophet. It was a remarkable book, moving the reader through his life and showing how aspects of his experience and the lessons taken from them are in dialogue with the revelation in the Quran. We encounter Muhammad putting a new civil order together, bringing unity to long-standing tribal feuds and cultures based on self-interest, reprisal, and vengeance. Muhammad, as legislator, judge, commander-in-chief, as teacher, spiritual counselor, and friend, are vivid. Like the Holy Theotokos, the Virgin Mary, for us Christians, the faithful of Islam see him as also being open to the divine word and a bearer of that word and a servant in making that word present to the life of the world. Over and over, we see him exercise mercy and compassion and encourage excellence, particularly from his companions. I recall thinking, when I finished that book, that if Muhammad had been an Orthodox Christian, he would have been regarded as a saint like no other. In the Orthodox tradition, we have saints who are warriors and conquerors. We have saints who are civilizing heroes, saints who are legislators, saints who are teachers, who are friends of God, spiritual fathers, and spiritual mothers, and those who have been, in a vivid way, messengers of God and embodiments of the gospel. We have hundreds of them. But I have never known one in whom all these aspects were held together. It was striking, and I began to understand a bit more deeply why there was a wound in the heart of faithful Muslims. that had its origin in this long tradition of awful rhetoric about such a remarkable human being. So for our discussion, let me finish by suggesting that Christians take up the suggestion of one of my interlocutors and seek to come to know Muhammad not as a competitor endeavoring to convert Christians, but as one who sought to be faithful to the deep call of the human heart to hear what God has to say to the human family, as one who risked his sanity by opening to what was revealed to him and who sought mostly to live the beautiful pattern of conduct. That is as much as we can say about any and all servants of God, and far more than we can say, at least I can say, about myself. What have we to lose as Christians to see Muhammad as a servant of God? What have we to gain as Christians to see Muhammad as a servant of God? I suggest, for the sake of our conversation, that we have one important thing to lose. We would no longer live under the shadow of enmity, as if a remarkable person in the 7th century and the community he called to faithfulness deserved anything less than being regarded as bearers of the divine image and seekers along the pathway of those who wished to be friends with God. And what do we have to gain? In our world, a world so fraught with hatred and death-dealing, the news is particularly grave the last few days, so fraught with selfishness and the appetite to devour whatever lays before us, in such a world, we would gain friendships forged by the recognition that each of us, Muslim, Christian, all human beings, are called to excellence, and that we have been called to find it on the other side of justice. So, that's it. We can talk together.